topic for tonight's review involves the second noble truth. We've been reviewing the four noble truths for the last few weeks. I was talking about the second noble truth. Last week, we talked about dukkha, which is typically translated as suffering. It's the first noble truth. The translation that I work with for distress and confusion. Stress is the emotional quality of dukkha. And it could be stress because you want something. I often believe that desire, we don't see that as dukkha. But when you want something, there's distress there. When you have it, there's distress because it's going to change. When it goes away, there's certainly distress. Of course, the more obvious understanding is the stress associated with unpleasantness, physical pain, mental pain, so forth and so on. Part of dukkha is much more of a spiritual consideration. The premise of Buddhism is that there is no enduring and autonomous separate self. All of our existence, subjectively, our egos, are comprised of interaction between environmental influences and memories internally. So we get confused about how things should be. We have certain expectations based on prior experience, which may on the surface seem completely reasonable, but we suffer when we are anticipating them occurring. We also suffer when they don't turn out the way we want them to. And that's because we have identified our subjective experiences being enduring and somehow or other should be in control. So that leads directly to the second noble truth. The cause of dukkha is craving and clinging. Craving relates to that emotional characteristic that I just described. Clinging relates to the cognitive element that I just described. So there's an important discourse. I actually reviewed it a couple of weeks ago. It's the Four Noble Truths discourse. Additionally, it's the first talk that the Buddha gave after his awakening. This is the excerpt from that discourse that focuses on the second noble truth. And this, monks, is the noble truth of the origination of stress, the craving that makes for further becoming, accompanied by passion, delight, relishing, now here, now there. That is, craving for sensuality, craving for becoming, craving for non-becoming. Now, this is a translation by Tanisiro, who is an American Theravada monk. But he uses the word stress, dukkha. So I'm going to talk about the elements of this particular quote more particularly, because one of the things that's important to understand about these discourses is that the terminology is very meaningful. And it's useful to understand it in the original Pali, which is the language of Theravada Buddhism. But also to understand that Pali was originated and promulgated in a culture that was constructed very differently than the culture we live in. So we have a responsibility to generation to understand how these concepts, this terminology, applied in terms of our own dukkha. So, first of all, craving is, Pali word for that is tanha, usually translated as desire or thirst, an unquenchable thirst. Temporary term would be an affect, affect. Basically, an affect is kind of an impulsive urgency. We talk about affect approach, which means it's a pleasant feeling. You want more of it. You want to protect it, enhance it. It's there. Or in the loss of it. Also, what's called affect avoidance, which means that the feeling tone is unpleasant. You want to avoid it. You want to get rid of it. It happens. So that's what tanha is, craving. Now, becoming, in the context of the discourse, can be considered in two ways. The traditional rendering is involves rebirth. You go through a whole lifetime living out your karma, and the residual impact of that karma shapes your rebirth. Rebirth goes on over and over and over again until there's final liberation from, ultimate liberation from craving and clinging through experience of nirvana. Now, when this particular concept was formulated in the time of the Buddha, rebirth was part of that culture. It's the way things were understood. So that's the way it was presented for generations. But then as Buddhism developed over the generations, different understanding of it, this notion of becoming, and it's more in alignment with contemporary understanding. Becoming is something that happens in an ongoing way. There's an experience that's first sensed. Maybe you see colors, and mind perceives that array of colors. It starts to differentiate that particular cluster of colors separately from the other colors that are surrounding it. And then that differentiation process continues, driven by craving and clinging. So there's a feeling of urgency, either pleasant or unpleasant. And there's also a kind of aggregation of memory that is has, may have some similarity to prior experience. So there's a momentary coming together of feeling and cognition. It creates a momentary self-state organization, which dissolves and immediately replaced by another one. I've talked about this many times. The most useful analogy or similarity has to do with motion picture film, which is outdated now. But, you know, motion picture film is basically a long strip of celluloid with individual images on it. If you look at it out of the projector, you see there's a bunch of singular images. But when you run it through the projector at the right speed, the right focus, and so forth and so on, the images flash up on the screen momentarily and go away, and another one flashes up and goes away. but the brain blends them together and they stream together, and it seems like there's somebody moving around on the screen. Well, that's going on all the time, even as I'm speaking right now, for everyone. This arising and passing away of self-state organizations. That's the becoming that is, I think, most relevant for our time. And it's actually validated by contemporary neuroscientific research. So this is what becoming is. Passion and delight rising now, here and right now. Passion and delight relishing now, here and now there, which talks about this drive, the affect. Passion has to do with the potency, the felt urgency, the demand of feeling. The light has to do with the heightened interest. A person can actually be delighted in their anger and their misery. We usually think of delight as being pleasant. But, you know, we've all experienced really getting into our anger or our grief. That's what we're talking about with passion and delight. This sense of engagement, of active. Craving for sensuality, that's is pretty straightforward. In terms of my own meditation practice, when my mind is quiet, breath with the body, not thinking, it's unusual. It doesn't feed the notion of there being an enduring autonomous self. So the mind will come up with all kinds of crazy images and fantasies. They just come and go, just pop up on the screen of the consciousness. I'm sure that everybody here has had that experience. That's, I believe, the mind convincing itself that it's real, that the self is real. Even though the fabrication is nonsensical, it's still somehow or other reinforcing or validating the ego. So this is part of that craving for sensuality. Craving for becoming is that affect approach that I mentioned earlier. Or pleasant experience. It might be physically pleasant sound or flavor, or it might be it might be a mental feeling of praise, or somehow or other having your sense of importance reinforced. And then craving for non-becoming is the opposite. It has to do with affect avoidance, or hindrance of aversion, ill will. What's perspective? So our task is to be able to notice these characteristics and be able to investigate them mindfully in a way that is not passionate. It's not hooked into craving and clinging. Now, I want to talk a little bit more specifically about affect. I mentioned it before. It actually is something that's used psychologically in terms of research. And the American Psychology Association has this definition about affect theory. The idea that feelings and emotions are the primary motives for human behavior with people desiring to maximize their positive feelings and minimize their negative ones. Within the theory, affects are considered to be innate and universal responses that create consciousness and direct cognition. 8 primary affects are postulated. The positive ones of excitement and enjoyment. The negative ones of distress, fear, shame, disgust, and anger. And the relatively neutral one of interest. Despite their biological nature and triggering mechanisms, primary affects are subject to significant social modification and social causation. Significant social modification. It's important. Another way to describe it in terms of neuroscience is what's called neuroplasticity. It means that, you know, the way the brain operates, the neural pathways are constantly buzzing. Even when we're asleep, even when we're not dreaming, we're absolutely unconscious. The brain is buzzing with neural activity, just not at the level of conscious awareness. That particular phase is out, if you will. So in that process, the experience of neural activity of neural activity, even though it's unconscious, has a value. It keeps the body alive. There's one of the theories is that there's a sorting process that goes on when we're asleep that kind of organizes memories. And memories are clusters of neural activity and disregards ones that seem to be irrelevant and associates ones that are seem to be relevant with each other. Now, that's something I'm going to talk about a little bit more later in the talk tonight. Craving is the precursor to clinging. Described it earlier, but I want to talk about it more specifically now. Pali term for clinging is upadana, which is translated as clinging, but also as attachment, grasping, fuel, or sustenance. I mentioned that Pali language was developed during the Buddha's lifetime and afterwards in the context of the larger Indian culture and all the suppositions that are there. The word upadana described the ritual practice that involved Brahmin priests putting sacred wood into the sacred fire. And that fire was meant to be kept burning perpetually in order to appease the gods. The Buddha repurposed this term, upadana. And what he was saying was the notion of an autonomous, enduring self, basically feeding. I used to think that upadana meant the fuel, but what it really meant was fueling, applying fuel. Another way to understand it would be food, just food. It's only when you eat it that it has relevance to our experience. So that's what craving and clinging involves, is this felt need to feed the ego. Now, the word ego came into being in the Western psychology at the end of the 19th, beginning of the 20th century. It basically, it what it meant was, what it indicated was a dynamic process of self-organizing. Freud was one of the people who really worked with it, and so did Carl Jung and others in the psychoanalytic field. Our ego as a noun, it's not. It really is more like a verb. So is a sorting process. First, there's perception. Perception, I mentioned it earlier, there's just light that's stimulating the optic process. Perception means that there's a certain part of that field of light that is really being honed in on with attention. Most of it drops away. That's perception. And that perception is just the initial response to a stimulus. Then there's a feeling that comes with it. And that feeling is a kind of a preliminary, fleeting operational assumption. Just a fraction of a second, bang. That fleeting perception is processed through parts of the brain and connects with certain memories. Now, memories have two different characteristics, two different modalities. One of them is affective. What that means is that when we have an experience, a memory is formed. It's kind of an after effect of the experience. It's basically stored in the way the neural pathways are connected with one another. When there's a strong affective element to that stored memory, it kind of gets priority, gets to go to the head of the line when a current experience has enough familiarity. This is how PTSD works, post-traumatic stress disorder. One of the characteristics of that is that, you know, a trauma is something that has a strong emotional impact. Being in an automobile accident, perhaps being seriously injured, or somebody important is killed, has a tremendous emotional impact on those who are in the accident, possibly to those who witness it. And that potency gets stored away so that when that person is in a car, they're more vulnerable to that kind of alerting response. So that's an emotionally driven process that pulls together a sense of self. In PTSD, that sense of self is very, very anxious and agitated and confused, because it seems like what they call flashbacks. It seems like you're back in that same event again, which is the confusion part of distress and confusion. Now, I was a psychotherapist for 30 years or so. I believe that a great deal of what people bring to psychotherapy, unless it's biologically based, is some kind of interpersonal trauma, what we would call attachment trauma, an attachment not in terms of craving, Buddhist terms, but it's a psychological term, which has some similarity. But the idea is that if you're in an important relationship dynamic, parent-child, let's say, and the parent does something that's harmful for the child, it may not be like, you know, physically punishing, but it might be shaming. There's a lot of emotion associated with that person's self-image. And when something happens that has enough similarity in terms of memory to that same kind of event, it stirs that person up, and they literally translate the event in ways that are dysfunctional. Example of that would be if a child is led to believe that their success or their value is related to their performance, they might develop a performance anxiety or perfection anxiety process, so that then when they're in a situation that requires performance, if they don't meet and exceed expectations, they believe that they are worthless. That's what we're talking about in terms of craving and clinging in that regard to a memory. And it's being fed. That's what the Upadama part is. It's being fed with more and more attention, more and more stronger and stronger reactivity. So that's one form of memory. Another form of memory is just simply habit, tying shoes, or learning a skill. Or to construct something. That's not so much involved with affect. It could be, but if it's just a performance like tying your shoes, there's little or no affective involvement there, unless you tie your shoes and they become untied and you start to feel imperfect and self punishing because of that. Live in a culture that is testing people, assessing performance all the time, graded in school. So that's part of our personality structures, for us to be aware that there's that kind of insecurity, the personal insecurity, afflicted by your craving and clinging. So this brings up metaphor of the second arrow, which is part of the Buddhist teaching. The idea is that if a person is wounded with an arrow, that's a physical injury. In Buddhist terms, it's called dukkha dukkha. Issues are torn, there's bleeding. So there's all kinds of pain and shock and so forth and so on. Metabolic disruption. The second arrow, which is Sankara Dukkha. We talked about this last week. Sankara Dukkha basically is what the mind makes of the experience. So without talking about arrows, if the first wound is your shoelace becoming untied. Well, that's just an unfortunate experience. Dukkha dukkha. Being upset about it is Sankara dukkha. That's the second arrow. The Buddha said we cannot control all the characteristics of first arrow. By the way, the third rendering of dukkha is term right now, but it's the kind of dukkha that comes about as a result of change, unexpected events. It rains on your parade or your shoelace breaks. Couldn't have predicted. So Sankara dukkha is the self state organization that is created as a result of that. So it could be one that's filled with distress and confusion. It also could be one, Sankara Dukkha, could be, oh, my shoelace is untied. I'm going to retie it and go on. So it's still a fabrication of the mind, but it's not afflicted by distress and confusion. Once again, the distress is the feeling of unpleasant urgency. The confusion is the expectation that your shoelaces, if they tie, you tied them right, will never become untied. If they become untied, it's because you're terrible at tying your shoes. I have become upset when my shooter came up time, speaking from my own experience here. Doesn't happen anymore. You just tie the shooter and move on. So that's a way to understand craving and clinging. Thriving nature of affect, which was described in that quote from the APA. Now I want to talk about the physiology of it. There's a part of the brain, it's called the limbic system. Limbic basically means the border, lining. We have what the outer layer, which is like the cortex. Then there's the center of the brain, which is a cluster of neurons called the thalamus, pituitary gland, hypothalamus. Between the cortex and the thalamic region is the limbic region. And that's where we process experience. That's where sensation starts to be interpreted, perceptions are formed. And primary neural pathways there are associated with what's called the amygdala, which basically is Latin for shaped like an almond. Hippocampus, which is Latin for shaped like a succumbens. I don't know quite what accumbens means. But the amygdala has to do with emotional response, the craving part. The hippocampus is associated with cognitive functioning. So it's the perception and clinging part. So the hippocampus and the amygdala are right next to each other. When we experience something sensational, pathways go to that part of the brain. It makes an initial perceptual assessment of what's going on. Hippocampus sends the signal from the amygdala and the hippocampus to the cortex, which starts to make associations with what the stimulus is, to identify it and come up with a plan of action. Another connection that goes on at the same time, which goes from those two neural pathways or neural clusters up to the nucleus accumbens, which is what prepares the body for action. And this is all deeply interconnected. Cortical areas and limbic areas are constantly feeding back to one another. Now, the craving part has to do with the energy of the nucleus accumbens. Pushing, take action, or freeze, don't move, don't move. I can also have emotional processing happens very quickly. The cortical process, where the memories happen, operate a bit more slowly, fraction of a second more slowly. They come together, and so the urgency of feeling can take precedence over rationality. The classic Buddhist example of this, you're walking down a pathway at night. It's not well lighted. And there's a sinuous form on the ground. Now, just me saying sinuous form, I can imagine your mind can jump to, it's a snake. There's an impulsive, instinctual reaction to that sinuous form. So there's a signal that's sent out to the brain and the body that says, emergency, emergency. Your muscles tense up, you feel startled, and you jump back. Fraction of a second later, there's more analysis going on. Self states are rising and passing away multiple times a second. But then further analysis reveals it's not a snake, it's a piece of rope. Now, when the mind is not well trained, you might not allow there to be enough time for further analysis. It might react as if it's a snake, turn around and run away. or stomp on it or whatever, you know, stupid thing to do with a snake. But there would be either, you know, there would be an avoidance affect. You want to run away or destroy it. What happens when you practice mindfulness meditation? Noticing and letting go that I alluded to in the guided Second Noble Truth contemplation that preceded this talk tonight. We posted on the website. It is posted on the website. With this. There's a buffer between that initial impulsive reaction and the actual behavioral response. So I'm going to tell a story I've told before, but it really illustrates this. I was getting ready to go to lead a retreat over in Tampa, the Franciscan Center. Went out on the porch in my house with baggage, and there was a black snake. And it slithered in probably under the garage door and found itself right up against the door to the house and the screen door that led out into the yard. And the snake is frantic. My dog is right behind me. There's this, notice it's a snake. I'm not particularly afraid of snakes. I noticed it. I noticed the dog. My alarm was, I don't want the dog to attack the snake. It's a black snake. They're harmless. So push the dog back. I got a broom or something and somehow or other managed to get the snake out of the porch. Went over to Tampa, Franciscan Center, my stuff in the room, walking around the grounds, and I looked down and there was a sinuous form in the leaves. Now, there was a flash, a fraction of a second of startle, followed by, that's a piece of coaxial cable that somebody dropped. It got partially covered by leaves. It was not a full-blown startle effect, just of alerting, immediately followed by recognition of what it really is. Now, this to me was the proof that my meditation practice actually works. It was this perception. The mind started to create some sort of response, checked it. And the checking happens through what's called the prefrontal cortex, front of the brain. Basically, its function is to monitor what's going on in the emotional part, the limbic system, and either sending a go signal to the nucleus accumbens and the amygdala, or a no-go signal. Well, because I had been training myself over and over again with mindfulness and breathing meditation to notice and let go, notice and let go, notice and let go, I was able to enhance the functioning of the preorbital cortex in terms of its ability to regulate emotional reactivity, overcoming craving and clinging, overcoming the second, and overcoming the first noble truths. Now, this can be applied to any number of things. For instance, my shoelaces. Actually, it wasn't my shoe becoming untied. It was my shoelace was knotted when I tried to untie it. And I would get upset about that. Then it doesn't happen anymore. My shoelace still gets knotted. I don't get upset. Same kind of thing. This is how we overcome dukkha. Is this kind of mental discipline. So, trying to do with our meditation practice in the context of the first and second noble truths is to be able to recognize how a particular self-state process is manifesting. Being able to assess whether that manifestation is wholesome. If it's wholesome, keep feeding fuel to it. If it's unwholesome, starve it. Don't feed it. Feed another pathway, in this case, the letting go pathway. So what this requires are three qualities of attention that we call the among the seven awakening factors. Mindfulness, which is being present of with present moment awareness regarding how the self is forming as a process. Investigation and mental phenomena, which is kind of an analytical approach, understanding how this sense of self is coming together. For example, this sinuous form on the ground in Tampa, noticing how it was starting to jump to the conclusion it's a snake. But then very quickly, less than a second, checking that and realizing, no, it's just a piece of wire. Referring back to the snake on the porch, it was a snake. I was not upset. I did not feel threatened. If there was any threat, it was that there was going to be harm to the snake or harm to the dog. Didn't want that either one to happen. But I was able to think clearly about the next step, right? So mindfulness, investigation of mental phenomena. Third, awakening factor is energy. In this context, it's right effort. The effort to notice where the energy of your attention is going and your tendency toward action, and to be able to regulate that effectively. If it's wholesome, go for it. If it's unwholesome, cease and desist, let it fade away, because it's changing. During that guided contemplation earlier, I made a few comments about noticing the change in the sensations, noticing the change in the mind's relationship to the change in sensations. That is what allows us to be able to notice and let go in terms of our realization of liberation from dukkha, liberation from distress and confusion, which is the third noble truth. The way we make that happen is the fourth noble truth, which is the Noble Eightfold Path, which is going to be involved with a whole series of reviews starting the week after next, I suppose. So these are my comments about the second noble truth. Now there's an opportunity for discussion, questions, comments about this. So anybody in the room or anybody in the Zoom room who has a question or a comment? Indy?
Talking to somebody this morning. Right before we hung up, I'm suffering right now. And into how this is not good and a lot of anxiety. I was this experience that I have. Mainly Vipassana changed my life completely. Just trying to explain to him, share my experience in between the thoughts and the finger. Face in between it. And I know that, you know, when you were getting into like the amygdala, the emotions, when the emotion happens and it's such a cool thing that happens at that point in time, like for first morning, you didn't even have to think about it. It's automatic. It's an automatic response. Able to maybe to get him to understand how that shift happens like the detachment, I guess, like to create the space that's needed in between the thoughts and the thinker, Raven and McClingan, just to give enough reprieve. Elaborate on that a little.
So when you say the thoughts, thoughts are mental objects. They're not a self. We identify with thoughts as this is me. This is real. This is important. No, they're just something that the brain creates. You know, just like the sun creates light and heat. Or water creates rain. It's a phenomenon of nature. But we tend to identify with the thoughts as this is who I am. The thinker, the thinker is mindfulness and investigation. Able to observe the process of thinking objectively rather than buying into it subjectively is an important part of how to manage anxiety. And to be able to say, oh, this is anxiety. These are the symptoms of anxiety. My breathing is irregular. My heart rate is increased. My thoughts are racing. This is anxiety. It's not me. It's an experience. And to have the strategies for learning how to use breath and body awareness to interrupt the oh my God story part of it and let the body calm down, because the fuel of anxiety is no longer, the fire of anxiety is no longer being fed fuel. That's how that change happens. It's a change in processing. You know, your friend, I don't know if he's a friend, this person you were talking to, quite possibly was caught up in the problem, preoccupied with what am I going to do, not paying attention to how can I calm myself down, which is a process that might help in solving the problem. See the difference there? Is that touching on what you're asking me? Now, how to get this person on board about that, that's a whole nother story. You know, you can share your own experience, and then he said, well, how do you learn to do that? Well, there's this thing called mindfulness meditation. You may want to consider it. And then you talk about what prompted you to do it. What prompted me to start mindfulness meditation? 40 years ago was a loss of a marriage and death of my father, and realized that my life was a kind of a train wreck. That made learning how to be mindful, how to let go, important enough for me to decide, I'm going to keep doing this. I'm going to train myself to do it because I know it works. You know it works. So you're providing an example to this person. Wow, she knows how to deal with this. I want that. That's when you say, well, I practice mindfulness meditation. But only when he says, how do you do that? That makes sense? You can't force people to accept help. You can offer it to them when they're ready. John?
I think another important talking to someone that doesn't sit, or even yourself, is that you think of yourself up and you react to that thought with this emotion. Sometimes you get so caught up in it that you can't go back to breath, you can't distance yourself. You identify, oh, I'm hurting, but that's the trap. That's the way to go back to breath, is to stay objective and to be able to disarm. And that's not easy. I've been that thing for a long thing you want to say for in that year. But the first one with TM, the point is that I get hung up in the last 6 months because I react to the words that I think with sometimes so hard that I get such an emotional hit that I can't go back to square one. It's amazing how you can set yourself up to get like a bowling pin, you know what I mean? You have to be able to go by breath and just let go. He doesn't understand that. Movements.
Stuka.
Other.
Can you speak louder, please? Take your mask off and speak louder. Say it again.
Considering other possibilities other than the one that's causing the anxiety.
Yes, that was the foundation of my whole psychotherapy practice. I was a practicing Buddhist before I became a psychotherapist, so I brought that whole understanding to graduate school. So I knew this when I went to grad school to become a psychotherapist. Absolutely right. Mindfulness-based cognitive therapy is organized around what I described in terms of being able to notice the process of thinking and then being able to assess, investigate and assess whether there's some kind of cognitive distortion going on, like perfectionism, and being able to see it as a dysfunctional way to be. And to put another story in there, which is, well, you know, shoelaces break, shoelaces get knotted. Okay, I'll just untie it. It's not a passing judgment on my capabilities. It's just an unfortunate event. And that cuts through the escalation. First, there's a noticing the knot in the shoelace. Then there's the anxiety that comes very quickly with, I screwed up, and they reinforce each other. Because the anxiety is building, it seems to make the I screwed up story more important, more determinative about my capabilities, my worthiness.
Or if someone gets tripped over, in that person tripping over the shoelace.
That would be another cause.
Anxiety.
Right.
You know.
But, right.
Yeah. So.
Right. So, yeah, that's cognitive-based cognitive therapy is very well researched, and it's becoming more and more standard in terms of cognitive therapy. When I went to grad school, they just said, change the way you think and things will get better. They never said feelings are important. But then over the years, now cognitive therapy says feelings are very important. You have to learn how to manage your feelings as you learn how to change the story. Acknowledge them as feelings, not as who I am. This is the feeling of anxiety, not that I'm anxious. It seems to be a trivial distinction, but it's very important. There's feelings of anxiety, then there's I'm an anxious person. I'm an anxious person is not effective. It's not beneficial. Anxiety as a feeling you can work with.
Also, not hurting yourself with your thoughts is the key to unlock that. So you're able to not judge yourself. You know, and let it go. And a lot of people can't. They just wind up and get more agitated because they don't have the way to.
Yep.
I think they're teaching schools. I think you should be talking about third grade.
So well, they are. They are in Miami and other places in around the country. It's part of the school curriculum.
Not for long.
No, it's part of the University of Miami's teaching program. And I understand what's going on with the government, but it's happening there. It's also happening in California. I was just reading about that today. Yes.
Yes. That I would like to ask. it happened tonight that, you know, I started chirping. And my mind loves the chirping. Can I not change chirping? You know, I meditation at home as well. I like to meditate on my back porch where I often am exposed to those nature sounds. And I find I love, instead of focusing on the breath, focus on the nature sounds. Is that permissible, or is that, don't take the mind away from the breath? Or can you do both at the same time? Because I sometimes feel like I'm able to do both at the same time.
So let's put this in the context of the guided meditation tonight. I said, watch your breathing. Establishes a stable point of reference. There's no craving and clinging with breath awareness. It's neutral in its feeling tone. It doesn't require any kind of story. Bird song happens. Just hearing the sound, and you're noticing that it's pleasant. Is there any dukkha in that? Is there any craving and clinging in that? The wanting is the craving and clinging. The listening is not. One of the things that I enjoy doing on a retreat when there are crickets around, there's usually like an orchestra of crickets. I pick out one particular cricket and try to notice it to the exception of all the others, because it trains me to notice perception, right? One particular cricket repeating its little melody, not all the others. And then noticing when I lose it, lose that focus, and then it comes back again, right? That's skillful practice. That's not craving and clinging. You can work with the sound of a bird when you're paying attention to the how the mind is creating a self relative to that sound. If there's a sound and you enjoy it, there's no dukkha there. If the mind craves it and gets upset when or preoccupied with it and does not want to stay present, instead gets caught into, wow, that's a really pretty bird. I wonder, you know, is that a mockingbird? Probably is a mockingbird. Isn't it great how mockingbirds have all these different interesting sounds? That's craving and clinging. You're not really paying attention to the sensation of the sound and the pleasantness of the feeling. You're caught up in a story. And ironically, at that point, you're not really listening to the mockingbird anymore. You're caught up in the story about listening to the mockingbird. See the difference? That's how you practice with this, noticing the effects of craving and clinging and being able to let go of it. When you're paying attention to the sound of the bird, you go back to the breath, you're reminding yourself to stay present for the sensation so that you're less vulnerable to getting caught up in that, oh, what a pretty bird story. See the difference? That's how you make this work.
I like the word noting.
Noting, yes.
Yeah. I noted it was a bird.
Right.
So I was still right on the breath.
Right.
Peter.
All right. Let's Sharon, go ahead, Sharon.
Yeah, it's interesting you're saying this. On Thursday, I was doing the Zazen sit walk out at Fish Lake, and there are a lot of birds, a whole lot of birds in there. On the shores of Fish Lake. And I was doing what, want to make sure I understood this, because I was doing what you're talking about. I was really focusing on the breath, but I was also sort of like switching between that and noting, I guess you can call it noting, the various songs of the different birds, because there was a whole variety of birds. And I was noticing it and being present with it, but then I started to think about it, which kind of interfered with my...
That's the craving and thinking. Thinking about it is the craving and clinging.
Right, exactly. And what I was doing was thinking, don't think about it, just go back to the breath and then go to the sound and listen to it. And it was pleasurable, but I wasn't getting caught up in the pleasure because I was aware that I could get caught up in the pleasure. So my thinking was, well, my noticing was that I was enjoying it, but then I'm thinking, no, breathe. Notice the breath. Notice the sound. So I was switching between one and the other. Is that okay? Is that what
That's okay.
About?
As long as you're mindful, as long as it's, you know, your attention is being guided by mindfulness, investigation, and right effort, it's okay.
That's great. Thank you.
Yeah,
really
the other thing I would say about listening to bird songs, it's also beneficial to notice the transitory nature of it. Does the bird start singing on the in-breath or the out-breath? Does the bird stop singing on the in-breath or the out-breath?
Wow.
If there's flock of birds, you know, being able to notice the syncopation of the sound and the impermanence of it, like I was talking about with the crickets, that's also skillful practice. It's not craving and clinging unless you get caught up in it. This is so cool story. Then it's a problem. All
that's
right,
great because, okay, thanks.
So we're running over on our time tonight. No, it was Steve Perlman. That was Sharon Lambert. So the topic for next week will be the third noble truth, which is liberation from dukkha, which, you know, traditionally, historically means the experience of nirvana. But that's not really what the third noble truth is about. Anytime you let go of craving and clinging, and your attention is just present without craving and clinging, that's a moment of awakening. That's a moment of liberation and freedom from dukkha. So that will be the focus of next week. I'm also going to talk about the transitions of awareness that are associated with nirvana. But for our level of practice, it really is about cultivating a more peaceful life that has more clarity and more enjoyment and more functionality without dukkha, less and less dukkha. All right, so let's sit for a moment. You well, folks. I hope we all have a safe and pleasant week till the next time we have a chance to gather.